May it please the court. My name is Angela Roth, and I represent the mother in this case, Ms. Alderson Cooley. And we had filed this request for appeal before this court today because we do believe that the ruling of the lower court was invalid for two reasons. And mainly it comes down to the question of what does the law say and how is the law supposed to be interpreted?
Before you get to that, and if you're going to answer my question later in your argument, feel free to do so.
Yes, sir.
Mother got notice of the hearing on the department's request, correct?
Yes, sir.
She didn't appear, correct?
She did not appear, Your Honor.
Why can she raise on appeal rulings that the trial court made when she had notice of the hearing, chose not to attend, and therefore, I think it's a fair assumption that there was nobody there to argue that the trial court had erred in the way that you're probably about ready to argue now?
Well, sir, I believe that the purpose of law for this, for all courts, is to ensure that justice is served. And justice, although Lady Justice does wear a blindfold, she is in fact not supposed to be blind. She's supposed to look at all of the facts that are before her. In this case, my client didn't show up to court that day. She did have notice. She was aware. She approached the department, Child Support Enforcement Services, and let them know that she really wanted a continuance, that she was having an emotional difficulty just even
Is any of this in the record?
Yes, it is, okay. Sir. And it actually is argued by both sides, mentioned first in the response brief, and then it's also mentioned in the record, Your Honor. And what had happened is that when she gave that letter, she was hoping that the department would, through their attorney, through counsel, request a continuance. But that was not requested. They went forward without her, and the record is devoid of any mention as to why my client wasn't appearing. It seems that the court specifically asked the department, do you know where she is? Do you expect her here? And the answer was, well, I don't know. But the answer should have been, well, we do know she gave us a doctor's note that said, please excuse her, please get a continuance because she's emotionally unable to represent herself at this hearing. But Your Honor, I think the other question before, as you are raising, sir, is that, well, why should she be able to even appeal a case when she was never there to present evidence? And I think that while a lot of times this court says, you know, we've made a decision because you haven't raised it at the lower level. But Your Honor, this is different because this is an issue that is actually where the court is supposed to follow a statute. And the court, looking at the record in the absence of my client and looking back at the record that occurred when she wasn't there, it's clear that the law wasn't followed. And I don't believe that it's the responsibility of that person to be present in order to raise that the law wasn't followed, because then why in fact do we have laws if
well, does the law wasn't followed response apply to the second branch of your argument dealing with the $9,600 and the insufficiency of the evidence?
Yes, sir.
Okay, what specific statute didn't the judge follow?
And I apologize, Your Honor, but that is case law, I believe, that defines what the courts mean by underemployment. So it isn't the statute that says these are the steps that we must follow in order to apply underemployment concept to a mother or a father in this case. But there is case law. And I do believe that the case law, regardless of whether it's raised by a party, should always be known and followed. Kind of like doing the right thing when no one is watching. I think that the reason
what's the difference between that and arguing that the judge made an erroneous ruling, and even though nobody objected to it, it's clearly erroneous, which is an argument that we would not entertain, possibly except in some criminal cases.
What's the difference between my argument?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's the difference between you saying the judge didn't judge didn't follow case law on under voluntary underemployment, etc., even though that wasn't brought to the judge's attention, and somebody standing at that lectern saying the judge made an evidentiary ruling that was absolutely contrary to every case that it addressed, and our response typically would be, yeah, but you didn't raise that objection, so we're not going to entertain it. Why is your case different?
Because, Your Honor, my understanding of the law is that it's to be applied equally. So if in, you know, looking at the first case, we're looking at clearly a statutory interpretation.
I'm not sure I understand that part of your argument, and I was moving on to the second.
Now you're looking, okay, so why could my client argue that the ruling was clearly erroneous when she never told the judge that you're not relying on the facts before you?
I see.
Well, Your Honor, because when, as I was describing with regard to whether or not justice is blind, the judge is sitting there. And I think the difference between a domestic relations case and your typical civil law case is that the civil law case comes before the court just that one time, typically. It's got one complaint, it's got one issue, and then once that case is closed, there may be appeals or maybe further post-trial action at the higher court level, but it typically isn't back at the lower court level. Whereas DR, it is absolutely dependent on every ruling in the past, and that case changes hands. So it started out as a divorce. In the divorce, the parents discussed what their income was and came to an agreement on child support. Then years later, it comes before the court again as to what child support should be. And the only evidence that came before the court and the only evidence that the judge relied upon was, hey, well, while we were married, early in our marriage, years before our marriage in 1993, she was earning $10,000 a month. And Your Honor, that doesn't make any sense to me that this is something that couldn't be raised, that because she didn't stand before the court, because she didn't appear that day, that that's not an argument that could be raised, because in my opinion, the court should have looked at the entire record and said, now, Mr. Alderson, what you're saying is that prior to your agreement on child support that the mother earned $3,000, prior to that she was earning $10,000, give me some information that would let me find now that she has the ability to do this. You're telling me she had the ability to do this 10 years ago, prior to even your divorce. Give me some information now. I don't, and Your Honor, I guess that's my point, is that it shouldn't be something that can only be raised by someone who is in attendance at the hearing. It should be the purpose of the tribunal is to seek the truth and to seek justice. And
let me ask, did your client file any post-hearing motions in the trial court for reconsideration?
Yes, sir.
And were these issues raised in those motions?
Yes, sir.
What did the trial court do?
The trial court upheld its ruling. It was very short and sweet, that it wasn't based upon her non-presence. It just said, we have all the information that we relied on is fair, and we're not going to change our decision based upon you now saying that you don't earn $10,000 a month. I don't believe that she raised the issue, Your Honor, of the retroactive nature of it. I don't believe that was raised in her reconsideration.
She was pro se throughout this proceeding?
Yes, sir. I came in to file the appeal, but she was pro se prior to me filing the appeal. And I, that doesn't excuse her conduct in not attending. It doesn't give her any reason. But I think that here it's a little bit more than just an evidentiary issue. It's a how do we apply the law to the facts before us? And in this case,
let me ask you another question. After the trial court denied her motion for reconsideration, did she then file her own motion for a reduction in child support?
Yes, sir, we did.
And what happened on that?
It was heard and it was reduced, but it's kind of strange. We actually went through and fully litigated the motion and came to an agreement prior to the court entering a ruling.
So except for the period between the first and the second hearing, the issue about the child support being too high,
yes, sir,
is moot.
As of the date that we modified it, yes, sir.
Retroactivity, was that readdressed?
The parties can't agree on that. The parties agreed that they would, that appeal has been submitted, and they would simply wait for the court ruling on that.
Let me ask you this, a further question. In the pleadings filed by the county,
yes, sir.
Did they ask for retroactive child support?
In the early one?
In the first round, when the county asked for child support, did they ask for retroactive child support?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. Okay. I don't recall. I remember looking at that motion, but I don't recall there being anything about this should go back to this date. I know it was a conversation held before the judge, and the judge said, when do you want this retroactive to? And they said to this, or I think the judge said, do you want this retroactive? Yes, ma'am, back to this date. But I don't believe it was specifically in the pleadings that, yes, sir, it was in the pleadings that the child had moved. I don't know if it said retroactive in their request for...
They said they may. I haven't looked at this pleading, but they may have stated when the child changed residence.
Yes, sir. I remember that. I just don't remember them saying in their prayer for relief that they requested retroactive. So, with regard to the arguments on retroactive support, it appears that the Child Support Enforcement Unit is saying, well, if you don't disregard what the law says, then it's unfair to the child. But to me, it's very clear that the statute on its face does not permit this type of retroactive modification, and that if in fact they want the law to be changed, then that is their responsibility, is to reach out. If the court remembers from looking at the record, the child was represented. The child had a CLR, a child legal representative. The father was represented. Both parties had counsel who could have properly, once they received the order from the court, said, wait a minute, you didn't address child support, and filed a motion at that time. Nobody did.
Ms. Rupp, does the record reveal to us why that request for a change in the child support, allocation of child support, wasn't requested earlier?
It doesn't. We don't have a response from the father. Child Support Enforcement does not represent the father, but Child Support Enforcement, their answer to why it wasn't filed any earlier is that they have regulations, and the regulations of their body is that we first seek to get an agreement between the parties, and then we give ourselves a timeline, and if we don't get an agreement, then we file. And so their argument is, wasn't delayed, it was done pursuant to our guidelines, but we could have done it earlier, so you should just retroactively modify it. And this is what I do, is practice a lot of family law, and so I have a lot of respect for the ability to mediate, but I also know my client's rights. And so the first thing we do is we file that motion for modification. We still go through mediation, we still do the right thing, but we file that motion in order to protect my client's interest in modifying that child support.
Do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
You're down to under 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You bet.
May it please the court, I'm Cassie Coleman, representing the Garfield County Child Support Enforcement Unit. And to start out with addressing Judge Roy's questions, this was not an establishment action. This was a modification of child support. So it wasn't a retroactive request for child support. We're just requesting the modification be effective the date the child changed physical care. The child, pursuant to an ex parte motion by the father and an order by the court on allocation of parental responsibilities, took the child out of the mother's home and placed him with the father. And under that,
well, the department did that. Some third party did that.
The department was not involved. It wasn't a DNF, but it was an emergency motion on behalf of the father.
That's right.
That occurred in March 2009, and so CSEU, my client, requested support then be the modification be effective April of 2009. Pursuant to Emerson and pursuant to the statute that we'll deal with later, 1410.122, subsection 5 specifically deals with the change of physical care modifications. But regarding the unemployment, it is our position that the mother just didn't appear. It's a factual determination by the court who to believe. The court took testimony from the father. He testified that the mother had the ability to earn $9,600 per month through her Mary Kay sales. She was on one of the upper levels of Mary Kay. He testified there was no reason to believe she couldn't continue that employment. And it is in the record that he did testify there's no, she had no disability or couldn't. It was her life choice to become a part-time substitute teacher and a life coach. And there is statutory authority on imputation of income and underemployment. It's 14-10-115, subsection 5B, Roman 3, capital B, deals with
Ms. Coleman, on the underemployment issue, how can we even defer to the trial court's findings when it didn't really give us a basis for that, to find an underemployment?
The basis in the record is that the father testified as to what the mother had previously earned and that there's no reason to believe she couldn't continue to earn that. I agree that the trial court didn't make specific findings as to why, but it can be inferred that the mother is essentially shirking her responsibility to support her child. And
on the motion to reconsider, did the mother raise the issue of insufficient evidence of underemployment?
I am not sure if she clearly stated that or not.
Before the lower court, did you raise the argument that the court's ruling should be reaffirmed simply because mother didn't appear and didn't contest them when she had a chance?
Yes, that's essentially our response to the motion for reconsideration, is she just didn't show up. This case, CSEU statewide has nearly 150,000 open cases as of the end of June. The issue of the effective date of a modification is of utmost importance to my client as well as the State Department of Human Services that's administered through the counties. My county alone processes nearly 100 modifications every year. Not all of those involve change of physical care, but there's the potential that those occur. And that's why the focus for us is a ruling from this court regarding the effective date of those modifications.
Did this arise because father came to you, or because father is receiving public assistance of some form?
There is no public assistance. The mother applied for our services in 2008 when I believe both of the minor children still resided with her. By the time the motion to modify was filed, there was only one. There's three children of this marriage. At this point, the youngest, Travis, is the only minor. So for purposes of that, we're only dealing with that. CSEU became involved on a voluntary application from the mother when she had the children. When the child went to live with his father, then he also requested our services, and we've continued to provide those on a voluntary basis. We believe the trial court accurately interpreted 14-10-122 subsection 5 in ordering that child support modification be effective as of the date April 1st, 2009, when Travis went to live with his father.
But doesn't the statute speak to a mutually agreed upon change in physical custody? Where's the mutually agreed upon part in this instance?
Quite frankly, I don't think there ever will be one. Ms. Alderson is ordered as to her parenting time not to have any overnights. I don't believe she agrees to that. I don't believe there ever will be a mutually agreed upon parenting time. As of March 2009, the court ordered what parenting time would be for Travis, and Ms. Cooley has complied with that order. And I would argue that that is, at a minimum, a mutually agreed upon change. Although she continues to litigate.
But the fact that she abides by a court order is indication of an agreed change?
Only because this happens in the majority of child support cases, where the parents are never going to mutually agree that Bobby can live with dad, or that they will always meet at the fire station and exchange the kids so neither one steals them. This comes up repeatedly, and I don't believe that that is a mutually agreed upon change, but when the court intervenes and says, now here's the overnights, that's what CSEU has to rely upon, because quite frankly, neither parent, neither being my client, will ever tell us where the kid is or that they agree with the parenting time, but they operate under the court order. And otherwise, there would never be, still today, Ms. Cooley shouldn't be paying child support because I don't believe she mutually agreed on Travis living with his father. And especially here, Travis is a teenager. I mean, this happens a lot in here. We have a court order. It's even more often in the child support cases that when they're teenagers, they just go live with dad and there is no court order and mom doesn't like it either. And every night mom calls dad and says, where's Bob? Why isn't he here? And or maybe he's not even at dad's and he's somewhere else. And that's what further complicates this in CSU cases, especially where there are public funds. It might not be either parent that should be receiving the child support. The kids are now living with aunt or uncle or best friend. And the person with physical care of the child is the one entitled to receive support. And so again, when we look back at actually the White and Martin ruling.
So you're saying you don't know in this case, you know for quite sure there was no voluntary change of custody.
There was not. It is court ordered and it continues in litigation.
And you don't know whether father has the child and is entitled to child support at all.
He, to the best of our knowledge, does based upon his affidavits, his statements, and his continuing position through the parenting time litigation that is ongoing. That's why the child has his own attorney, as Ms. Roth referred to. That's outside of child support. Mr. Alderson's also represented in that and not with the child support.
Let me try to summarize what you've been saying. Isn't there a bright line test in the statute that if it's a voluntary exchange of custody, this child support adjustment is retroactive, and otherwise it's real time based on the filing date of the motion?
I thought so until the White and Martin case came out in 2010. And that, the Emerson case, both of these are cited in my brief, but the Emerson case is from 2003, one division of this court. In 2010, the White and Martin case came out. And up until 2010, we believe there was a bright line test because 1410.115 subsection 5 specifically says that when the child changes, or when there's except in the case of mutually agreed upon change in physical care, it's the date of the filing of the motion. When White and Martin came out, in that case, it's factually distinct from here. In that case, the mother says she allowed the child to go live with her father. And they both agreed no child support would be paid from either one of them. And that went on for a few years, at least a year. And then the father filed a motion requesting child support be modified back to the date he took physical care of the child. And actually, I believe this factual distinction is in Justice Loeb's concurrence, where he talks at length about how this, it was essentially a estoppel argument or detrimental reliance by the mother, that that's really what was going on. And they found that the statute, both Emerson and White and Martin say the statute is clear and unambiguous, and they come to drastically different decisions. But both of them say that clearly whoever was paying child support, their obligation ends when they take physical care of the child. In Emerson, the court went on to say, so then the other parent's obligation begins that day. In White and Martin, the court looked at it and said, no, because of the language of the statute, it says the obligor's obligation is effective. And they looked at that language and came out and said, even though the father's obligation to financially support the child, there was no more cash payment required when he took the daughter, that the mother's obligation didn't start until the mother filed the motion, or until the father filed the motion for child support. That reasoning leaves the child without support, and it does terminate child support during the child's minority, which is a violation of the statutes and the public policy that children are entitled to support from both of their parents throughout their entire minority.
Here's where I'm losing you. It's an excellent argument, but what I'm hearing you make essentially are policy-driven arguments that would be better made to the legislature. I don't hear you pointing to ambiguity in the statutory language that would be our province to interpret to afford you the relief you're seeking.
I believe there may be a basis for a statutory change, and I believe CSEU is also recommending those changes to the legislature. But in the meantime, we have two divisions of this court coming down saying the statute.
You think Emerson's right?
Emerson is more clearly reasoned. I believe White and Martin is factually distinct because there was an agreement between the parents that neither would pay support during that time. What I do find interesting in both those cases is neither of them involve CSEU. Neither of them involve public services at all. And the CSEU process and Department of Human Services has the largest stake in this. And ever since the White and Martin case came down, it's really made it difficult to determine when child support should be modified in changes of physical care cases. What's further complicated when CSEU is involved is that 2613.121 governs CSEU's modification process. So when somebody comes to our office and requests a modification, which they're entitled to do, there can be at least a 3-month delay until we even file a motion to modify. And that's all statutorily required, that there's 30 days for the parents to respond. And if one of them doesn't agree on the change of physical care, they're not really likely to send their information back right away. Then CSEU has 30 days to review the information and come up with a recommendation. This legislature came up with a system that essentially delays any filings of motions to modify. And that was done to make judicial efficiency happen so that CSEU is administering child support cases and only filing really the contested ones that we can't get a stipulation on.
But in this case, we have much more than that statutory 3-month delay, correct?
After Mr. Alderson applied for our services and then requested a modification, I believe there is somewhat of a delay. Some of that is administrative, of sending out paperwork, waiting for things to get back. Both, for a time, had attorneys, and they were requesting things. Then the motion was filed, and requesting back, pursuant to Emerson, back to the date of 2009, which was prior to the White and Martin decision. So I also believe that that was correct. Procedurally, there was no case law in 2009 saying anything other than it was the date the child moved in with his father. The other thing, the problem with the White v. Martin, or White and Martin case, and the reasoning in that, is that it essentially obliterates subsection 5 of 1410.122. That is the one that says it's always the filing date of the motion, and that's why the end of the month is extremely busy for our office to get the motions to modify filed so that they're effective the first of the next month. In changes of physical care, that's supposed to be different pursuant to subsection 5, but White v. Martin says it's not. It's still the filing date of the motion. So I believe the clear and unambiguous language in the statute should be effective through subsection 5 to create this exception for when children change physical care. It's also important to note that if the child were to go live with the aunt under the White and Martin decision, then whoever was already ordered to pay child support would continue without the need for a filing of a motion. However, the other parent who now gave the child to aunt would not be obligated to support their child until aunt actually filed in motion. So even though I believe the case law is clear that parents have a moral and legal obligation to support their children all the time, the White v. Martin case, or White and Martin case, essentially eradicated that. Thank you.
The White and Martin case supports your position?
No. The White and
what Martin, is your position?
Our position is that the Emerson, the interpretation of 1410.
And it should be as of the date they physically changed custody.
Yes.
Even if that was pursuant to a court order.
Correct.
And you're, I don't mean to be sarcastic, but you're asking us to equate voluntary conduct with compliance with a court order.
Yes.
Any case that's ever said?
Not that I am aware of.
Thank you. May it please the court. The court did ask prior counsel if, in fact, my client had raised the argument of insufficient evidence to the prior tribunal when she had filed her motion for reconsideration. And she did. The way I believe she did it was that she said, I don't make that. I haven't made that in years. And I turned in all of my information to child support enforcement, which I assumed was turned into the court, so you should have relied on that. And so when I came into this case and we filed this appeal, looking very closely at what happened when she wasn't there, it's very clear that CSEU put forward all of her income documentation, and that CSEU is asking this court to rely on the sworn testimony of the father in determining that that was sufficient evidence not to overturn the ruling on underemployment.
Let me try to clarify something you said earlier.
Yes, sir.
She never raised, including in the motion to reconsider, this retroactive argument, correct?
I don't think that she did, but I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And when we filed our motion, we were looking over what had been put before the court, and it was her tax returns, her income documentation, 1099s, all the information from Mary Kay, who is the exact same employer that the ex-husband describes, and none of it matches what he said. So it's our position that the court should have looked at these documents and decided that this is insufficient evidence for me to find that I should impute this income, because there's nothing here to impute that income. Thank you.
Let me ask you a question. The allegation was made that your agency knew mother was not going to appear and had some sort of physician's excuse. Do you acknowledge that, or do you dispute that, just for purposes of?
I believe it's in the record. What happened is our office received a doctor's note from Ms. Cooley. I don't know. Our dockets, this was set on a trailing child support docket. They start at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons. I'm usually out of the office by noon. And so I don't know. I don't remember if I received that document before I went to court or after as to why. And the note didn't say she wouldn't be appearing. It was a note from a doctor. And we did see if she called in.
You didn't know about that note when you went to court?
I can't say whether I received the note or not.
Is the note in the record? The doctor's note?
It was not submitted to the court, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I thank counsel for the briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.